What would you say were the qualities of a good surgeon? You might have steady hands on the list and a strong stomach or fierce commitment, because it takes years of study before you even get to surgical training. Lots of women have all those things, but many of them are leaving surgical training even if they've worked really hard for years to get there. Dr. Ria Liang is a general and breast surgeon and head of the With Respect Committee at the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. And Dr. Joan Arakul is an orthopaedic surgeon and author of a new memoir called Slice Girls, about the experiences of women surgeons. Joan, why did you become a surgeon, and what drives your colleagues, both men and women, to put in all the work it takes to become a surgeon?
The decision to become a surgeon is made somewhat early on when, you know, you decide whether you want to be a hands-on person or more of an intellectual type when you go into general medicine. So it's just basically personality types that go into these different choices, I believe.
I imagine it takes quite a lot of commitment too.
It does indeed, because it's years and years of training. And like you say, it's not just the personal commitment that's required of you. It almost takes a society and a country to make especially a female orthopaedic surgeon. So yes, there is a lot of commitment involved.
So Ria, what's going on? Why are we seeing this mass exodus of really dedicated people?
The thing that was really interesting to us and which triggered off my research was the thought that, you know, we've made such great strides for women in lots of areas, and feminism has been going for a good 30 or 40 years in full force, but we're hardly moving the needle in surgery, particularly compared to other specialties. And so what we found was actually it's not one thing, it's 100 different things. And the reason we're not making a difference is because we tend to focus on one thing after another, you know, whether it's work fatigue or sexual discrimination or Indigenous matters or LGBT or whatever, but you have one campaign after another, when in actual fact my recent research suggests that there's a cumulative effect. It all piles up. And so these things are not unique to women. Actually, everyone's piling these things up, but women have got more things to deal with, because we have, in addition to the long work hours and the fatigue and all those demands, we've got sexualized aspects such as pregnancy and childbirth and sexual harassment, which have tended not to be dealt with very well in surgical training.
Some of the stories were awful, just sexualized images around the workplace, really basic things. How are they still permitted to go on?
Well, it's what I like to sometimes call the Donald Trump effect, you know, boys will be boys, because even now, so when I started the research, we were in the single digits and we had a little two-digit party when we got to 10%. We're up to about 12% now.
Of female surgeons?
So across the whole surgical fellowship, about 6,500 surgeons in Australia and New Zealand, 12% are now female. And of course, that bump from 9% to 12% has all happened in the last few years. So, but that still leaves 88% male. And so it just gets a bit locker roomy. You know, the males are never malicious, I find. If you get them by themselves, one by one, you know, to have a cup of coffee with or whatever, they're fine. But you put them in a group together and there's a certain groupthink and culture that gets established.
And tell us how that pressure not to speak up manifests on women.
Well, the thing is, you're already very much the other person in surgery. You feel different all the time, and that's manifested in lots of tiny ways, in terms of the equipment that you're provided with and the fact that things only come in large sizes and where equipment is placed. You know, some of the equipment that we need for our surgery is placed within the men's changing room, because that's the only place it's ever been needed, for example. So there's all these microaggressions that make you feel different. And then you add on to that the layers of inflexible training, during which it's very hard to, you know, have children and look after them. And the frank sexual harassment, you know, all the little comments about why women shouldn't be in surgery, or, you know, as we saw with Dr. Cardota recently, being labelled an emotional female, when in fact, you know, if you're already working very long hours and so forth, you've really shown that you are pretty darn tough. You know, that label was very unfair.
So this is Dr. Yumiko Kadota, who quit eventually, but only after repeatedly raising the concerns of her excessive fatigue and overwork and worrying about the impact on her skills and training. I mean, why is there an unwillingness to listen to people who are saying, I have the best interests not only of myself but of patients at heart?
Yeah, so the difficulty is that surgery has always been aligned with military training. You know, there's this glory in being able to do it harder than anyone else, staying awake for longer, fitting in the most number of cases in an operating list, being able to operate faster and harder. I call it the notches on the bedhead sort of problem. You know, it's a quantity over quality. And so I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit as a surgical profession, because people who are aware of their own performance degradation when they're tired, people who want to give of themselves and spend an extra 10% talking to their patients and communicating well with them, people who would like to work reasonable rosters and be a whole person so that they can give of their best at work, these are the people we're actually driving away. And I think if you ask the general public, that's possibly not what they want from their future surgeons.
We're talking with Dr. Ria Liang, who's a general and breast surgeon and head of the With Respect Committee at the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. And with us too is Dr. Joan Arakel, orthopaedic surgeon and writer. Joan, tell us a little bit about your experience. You practiced in India and the UK before Australia. What did you observe in terms of women in surgery across the board in those places?
First of all, I must say I do agree with most things that Ria said in terms of what ails the surgical community today. What I'd like to also point out is that while we have seen through an external advisory group that there is a significant issue with discrimination, bullying and sexual harassment, predominantly against women by the fellows of the Royal Colleges, and this is a troubling and damning indictment of the Royal Colleges itself. The important thing is that, as I see it, is that if you were to look at discrimination, bullying and sexual harassment as the main issue that's ailing us, we are actually going to be addressing the symptom and not the disease that ails the whole community. And that is where I think we have to look at why this is happening. And I believe the real underlying problem is the near monopoly that the Royal Colleges have exerted in deciding who and how many can practice surgery in Australia. So while we call it a boys' club, it is indeed true, and this is something that does not work for the public. And what this boys' club has essentially done is it has used the monopoly power to restrict the number of surgeons and consequently allow its members to charge high fees. So effectively, it's functioning as almost like a cartel against Australia. So this is, I think, what is somewhat of a strong thing. Now, coming to your question, Hilary, how I see the difference between, having trained in India, UK and Australia. So in India, basically, you have two levels of performance that goes on. So poverty and the associated features along with that, like lack of literacy, is a significant issue. So you find that women are mired to the sticky flow and, you know, they find themselves very hard to price themselves off. And that's what you associate with all the negative impact of that you see around, whether it's in the media or elsewhere. But equally, women who have priced themselves off the sticky floor are more or less allowed to rise high. So I would think that the glass ceiling that we talk of is not so much of an issue in India, while the sticky floor is not so much of an issue in Australia. And that, I think, is primarily the main difference that I see.
And Joan, I was interested to hear in the book about some of your experiences working in orthopaedics. What was that like as a woman entering that field?
Well, initially, when I entered the field, I did not realize that I was much of a freak, almost to say. The training period was quite fantastic, and it was demanding, without a doubt, but that's what you go in for when you sign up to do any surgical speciality. But I was very well supported, as I mentioned in my book, and it was only later, it's only today, that I realized the value of that support, because I realize that's not across the board. You know, you don't necessarily need to get supported in that fashion. And so it allowed me to complete my training and left me with a very good feeling. And then I went on to work in various positions. And it was pretty much, if not smooth sailing, it was reasonably good and enjoyable and exciting to do that. So orthopedics is a fascinating subject. And, you know, it's been the love of my life and remains so. But the other problems that you encounter along the way in practicing this speciality is what is posing a much greater challenge, not the work itself. Cutting, chopping, sewing, or researching, they're all fun things. And I mean, they're all something rewarding and something that you set out to do.
Now, Ria Liang, I was a bit stunned to hear about some of the attitudes to things like taking maternity leave, but even going to a relative's funeral. How is this environment outside the normal workplace health and safety laws?
Yes. So, I mean, of course, this isn't a female-only problem. This affects everyone. And so the women become the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, because, of course, being slightly more socially aware and slightly less willing to make those very rather socially unacceptable compromises, you know, to put your surgical training ahead of the funeral of a close relative, you know, that becomes an additional discriminator, you know, because it becomes survival of the most socially unaware, so to speak. Those things persist because it is quite competitive, and Joan has alluded to it. We have far more applicants than we can possibly train to surgery. I take a slightly different view to her view about the monopoly. You know, I've always taken the view that it's much better to change things from inside the structures, and so I work with the college to get these things changed. But essentially, surgery is like trying to learn a musical instrument or learning a sport. There is no operation that you can do more than once. And so while you can increase training numbers for physicians, for example, because, you know, an interesting patient with a heart murmur, you know, six or seven different people could listen to that heart murmur and learn something from that case. If there's an appendix to be taken out or a gallbladder, it can only come out once. So by increasing training numbers significantly, you will decrease the quality of the training that you provide. This is our central problem. It's not an externally imposed monopoly. It's just a practicality of trying to train people sufficiently to be proficient. Within that, because it's so competitive, people are willing to make some astonishing sacrifices. And so, like I say, we're almost selecting for people who don't care about those things because they're willing to make those sacrifices to the layperson seem quite outrageous.
Ria, were you ever thinking about leaving?
Twice.
What yes. happened?
And both times, serendipitously, someone would pick up the phone and say, "You're all right, you're not quite yourself, you know, and actually we do want you and we think you're good and, you know, please come back." I think what we need to work hard at in surgery is turning these serendipitous little encounters, as Joan was saying, you know, landing in a unit that's supportive, having a slightly more gilded path. There are clearly others, such as Dr. Yumiko, who fall into places where this is not the case. So we have to turn serendipity into something systematic that we can offer to all our young doctors.
So, Joan Arickle, just to finish up with, what would be the thing that you would change to help shift this culture to something that's more welcoming of women?
Well, just like Ria said, she suggests that it would be impossible to raise the numbers. Now, what we have to say is that the solution offered by the Royal Colleges in response to the EAG findings is twofold. One is to increase, investigate the EAG, and the other is to give take affirmative actions in favor of women. Now, and the other one is the 10-year plan they've rolled out in order to address the issue of discrimination and bullying and sexual harassment. What I'd like to know is, would we have accepted it if the banks told us they have a 10-year plan? Would we have accepted it if the Catholic Church offered us a 10-year plan? You know, health is the second biggest item in our national budget. We spend over $160 billion on it annually. And if there's a rot in the heart of health, we cannot hope for it to be solved through some navel-gazing by the Royal Colleges, the very body that benefits from the rot. We need an open inquiry into the AAG report, and I basically believe that we need a Royal Commission, just like we did with the banks and the Catholic Church.
So, Joan, you'd like to see big change fast by the sound of it. Thank you both so much for coming on the program today. Dr. Joan Arickle is an orthopaedic surgeon and author of a new memoir called Slice Girls, and Dr. Ria Liang is a general and breast surgeon and head of the With Respect Committee at the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. You're listening to Life Matters.